Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. And this is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Although these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, if you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you'll get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the remedy and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
All right, well, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. So without further ado,
and we appreciate your ramble, Martin. I'm sorry I had my microphone muted again. I always am doing that. I don't know why. We have several new callers on tonight, and I want to cover some court cases with you, things that will make you go, what did he say? Because these court cases clearly delineate between two classes of people, each of them defined as United States citizens. Why is this important? Because the presumption is always, underscore, always by the courts, that you are one of the citizens that truly have no rights from the Almighty One. And the other class of citizens, the United States is barred from even communicating with you unless you've actually committed a crime that would be originally deemed a common law crime against persons or property. So we visit Maxwell versus Dow. This is 20 SCR at pages 448 and also page 455. The privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States do not necessarily include all the rights protected by the first eight amendments to the federal Constitution against the powers of the federal government. So right here, they're saying that citizens of the United States are not going to enjoy the first eight amendments of the Bill of Rights. U.S. versus Valentine's, 288, F. Sup. 957, quote, the only absolute and unqualified right of a United States citizen is to residence within the territorial boundaries of the United States. The word residence is a legal term. And by definition, it means that you are domiciled in Washington, D.C. That means that that's your main place that you live, but that you are having a residence within one of the, quote, freely associated compact states. Again, as a citizen of the United States, your only right is to live amongst the free men and women of America. Wheeling Steel Corporation versus Fox. Therefore, the United States citizen, open bracket, as if there's any confusion here, citizens of the District of Columbia, close bracket, residing in one of the states of the Union are classified as property and franchises of the federal government as an individual entity. Now, let's talk about the word property. A slave is owned by the slave master. The last time we really thought about this in any kind of form of reality was in the Old South, you know, the movie Roots and other movies that have come up where there was, you know, white slave owners that owned slaves from Africa. They were their property. Yet here, in something very current, they're saying that U.S. citizens, i.e. citizens of the District of Columbia residing in one of the several states, are property of the United States. You're still a slave under the 14th Amendment. We'll get to that in a second. Now, as property, if you were a cattleman and you wanted to vaccinate against hoof and mouth disease and you're on your herd, your property, could you vaccinate without getting permission? Sure you could. If you were a rancher, a horse rancher, and you wanted to protect your horses against equine encephalitis, could you vaccinate your horses? Well, of course you could. If you're the Congress and you want to vaccinate your two-legged property that we call citizens of the United States, could you vaccinate them, say, against COVID? Well, sure you could, in law. Can you vaccinate one of the citizens of the freely associated compact states? Absolutely not. Hendricks versus Maryland. A U.S. citizen, upon leaving the District of Columbia, becomes involved in interstate commerce as a resident and does not have the common law right to travel of a citizen of one of the several states. How many times have you met somebody or heard somebody talk about your right to travel and you rolled your eyes and kind of chuckled and, you know, shook your head? Who is idiots? Yet right here in Hendricks versus Maryland, they're saying that there is a citizen who has the right to travel. No driver's license, no proof of insurance, no registration. They have the right to travel. In fact, you can restate this and delete the right to travel and just say simply, as a resident does not have the common law rights of a citizen of one of the several states. It still works. Have you ever wondered why the Second Amendment says shall not be infringed? Yet if you wish to have a concealed weapon, you have to go through a background check. That's infringement. It might be wisdom, but it's still infringement. You have to pay a tax. You're told where and how you may carry. You're told, you're governed down to the minutest detail on where and what and how, what you may do with your firearms, if you qualify. Does that sound like any kind of infringement? So the citizens of the several states, it's nothing. There is no permission to request. It's the permissions, the fact that the Almighty One told us in the scriptures that we could protect ourselves. He said, you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and get a sword. But property doesn't have that option. A citizen of the United States must abide by those laws. City of Dallas, the rights of individuals are restricted only to the extent that they've been voluntarily surrendered by the citizenship to the agencies of government. Wadley versus Newell. It's a circuit court case out of Northern California. This is March 13, 1905. Quote, civil rights under the 14th Amendment are for federal citizens and not state citizens. Well, stop right there. They're telling you you have two classes of citizens there, federal and state. When you go to court, whether it's for a traffic ticket or you're charged with, I don't know, maybe they found a dime bag in your car or something on your person or whatever. Does that apply to state citizens? No. Does it apply to federal citizens? Yes, because they have no rights. It says so right here. And further, in this case, it says, and as parents have no right to the custody of their infant children except subject to the paramount right of the state. When you get a marriage license, do you realize that you got entered into a three-party contract? Not with the creator, man and the woman, but with the state, the man and the woman. The creator of the universe is not even in it. And the state is a superior party to the contract. That's why you have no right to your infant children except subject to the paramount right of the state. So these are the things that I wanted to share with you. For all you new first-timers, now there's a lot of people on the call that have heard me talk about this so many times before, but this is what it's about. And what PJ is going to share with you tonight, and there's more than PJ. He's the point of the spear. He's the one that does the heavy lifting. There are several other people behind PJ that support him and are able to take a stand with him or without him if it ever we ever have some, you know, you never know when I'm going to take my last breath. PJ never knows when he's going to take his last breath, and it goes on from there. We have a 100-year plan in place. What I mean by that, we have people that are there to replace people if it becomes necessary. You're being told about this, the new people on the call, you're here mostly from Michael G's group, and you're here, you know, wondering what we're talking about when you were on the Saturday call and on the other calls and encouraged to be on this call, because these are the people, should there ever be a claim by the government, and there has not been in 27 years since Bernie started doing this, there's never been any intercourse with the government whatsoever on these matters. But should it happen, these are the people that are going to step forward, and they're going to become special agents within your corporation's soul, within your trusts, with limited power of attorney to, if necessary, even walk into court to defend the trust. And so without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to PJ. PJ, how's it going?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, basically, I'm the individual that goes where angels fear to tread. A lot of the people I work with, they are retired from high levels of law, and they wish to kind of remain in their retirement status, and they don't really want a lot of trouble, but they do specialize in certain areas. And when I have a question or we have a question, we pretty much know who those people to turn to ask for guidance. And it's been a tremendous help. We have probably 100 people that we call on across the nation. And a great number of them realize that our country is in a downward spiral, and they believe that it's their duty to do their part in bringing back to where it's supposed to be. And believe it or not, the Constitution is our number one tool, the Bill of Rights. Michael talked about the right to travel. If you're a United States person, they'll say you have a right to travel. And you'll go, oh, great, great, great. And then you say, you have a right to travel if you got a driver's license, registration, insurance, and blah, blah, blah. So they'll use the same words. And they'll talk about your right and all this. And then they'll talk about taking your right away. Now, if you can take a right away, it's probably not much of a right. Now, really, in common law, I guess you can take somebody's right away. If I go out and start murdering people, they'll take my right to freedom away. I forfeit my right. But the right to travel, if you are out there going to the store to get food for your family, and you're one of their persons on their land, they'll claim to have the right to regulate you with license, registration, insurance, and all state and federal statutes that apply to you in that activity, which is pretty pretty costly at times. We have people that buy brand new cars. Some of the cars cost $100,000, and we're able to show them how to not pay any taxes on the car and not register it and not license it and not even insure it if they don't want to. Now, if you don't insure it, you better have a means to protect your fellow man if you do damage. It's just you have a responsibility there to do that biblically. The right to carry a gun, the right to protect yourself, the right to feed yourself, the right to get to the grocery store, the right to get to the hospital. The judge, when you're in a U.S. court, a lot of these judges are actually starting to learn some of these technical aspects of the distinction between the man and the person. When I say person, I'm talking about a statutory person, because they define the word person in their statutes as a basically a franchisee, an association, the same words that you describe legal entities with. And then we like to use just the flat-out word man. And recently, Michael has helped us to understand why we should avoid certain words like civil rights. If you go in there and start talking about civil rights, the judge will use that as a something to actually push you over to the statutory side. And that's the last place you want to be. Yeah. If you're on a statutory side, you're going to be judged by their jurors, controlled by their judge, their administrator, and their prosecutors and their attorneys, and you are the least person in control of that setting, if you have any control at all. Whereas on the common law side, you go in at an equal basis with your opponent. Your opponent cannot be represented, and if they're a man. Now, if they're an entity, I don't exactly know how that works, but they have to be represented somehow. I just haven't got into that situation yet. But maybe Michael has insight on that. So what we're doing recently is we're being extremely successful in IRS cases. We are able to basically paint the prosecutor into a corner to admit that certain people, not everybody, certain people have no obligation to file and no obligation to pay any money to the United States. As a right, as a God-given right, they have no obligation. If you have to file a form with the United States, you are governed, okay, under the laws of the United States, if you have to do that. Now, if you don't have to do it, the requirement to file does not even touch you at all. They don't want anybody to know that. They don't want anybody to even think about not paying federal taxes. The small number of people that there's quite a few people that don't pay federal taxes, but a great many of those people that don't is just simply because they're able to go from job to job and hide their income and all this stuff. But for me, for example, I bring in 15,000 to 20,000 a month, and 28 houses and a farm, and I'm not going to hide at all. And I go right into federal court and tell them, you got any evidence that I'm required to file? You got any evidence that I'm required to pay? Any money's over? If you do, bring it on and bring the witness, because I've got some questions to cross-examine them with. And they know that I know how to ask the right questions, how to keep the burden of proof on them. And they don't ever bother me. It's been at least 20 years. And not even a hint of problems. In the beginning, they used to send me their little forms and threaten me with possible prosecution and all this stuff, and I just sent the package that we have assembled to them, and they just back off. They don't want ever to put a knowledgeable person through a trial because he will expose the way that you can actually prevail in a U.S. court in the IRS cases. We have an individual right now that they prosecuted. They found him guilty, and we're able to prove that they didn't even have any authority to take him to ask him to plea, to arrest him, to put him in front of a jury for a trial, to put him in jail. And it looks like we're going to get a judgment here real soon on that, where he'll be released. And then guess what? They're going to do it in such a way that it's going to look like just basically an error. They're not going to admit that the man has no evidence that he has a requirement to file or pay. They've worked it in such a way that I think they even instructed the attorney to screw it up so bad that the case can be thrown out on his so-called mistakes, his errors, so that they don't have to write any findings of facts or conclusions of law that this individual has no requirement to file and no requirement to pay. Now we have a package where we can actually work with various people to build evidence against the IRS that you're inquiring about any requirement to file or any requirement to pay, and that's very important to do that. I have some clients that do it every year. I used to do it every year, but I don't so much anymore because I pretty much know how to handle myself if they ever come after me. But if you're on a little bit thin ice and you kind of want to help your wife to be a little bit more at ease, you can send these packages, templates in yearly through us. So far it's been 100%. Keeping them off our clients' backs, 100%. I've been doing this for 30-some years. We've won every case that's gone to IRS, against the IRS. There are some cases we did not take on because the client actually had a legal duty to file and pay. The client was a U.S. citizen, or the client was having income domestically in the United States. If you are a person having income that is derived from activity domestically in the United States, you have a requirement to file and pay. Or at least you have a requirement for somebody to file some documents and pay. I mean, you can always walk up to the United States and say, hey, I made some money domestically in your land, and I understand the rules that you got to pay some tax on it, and you guys need to do that for me because I'm not an accountant. I have no means to even hire an accountant to do it for me. And your law says that you have to do it for me. So, and they will. If you are a person that's required to pay any taxes, they will assess you and tell you exactly what to pay. So, as far as other issues, they basically, when it comes to the United States, they all boil down to the same thing. We keep the burden of proof on the United States, force them to produce evidence that they have requirement. They have the authority to do what they're doing, may it be in property taxes, municipal codes, housing codes. We have an individual now that his daughter, out in California, his daughter started kind of cracking down on his daughter and making her follow biblical standards, and she just had enough of that, and she ran down to the police station and filed a claim that he molested her 10 years ago, and we found out later that she'd kind of gone berserk and said that all her brothers did the same thing, every indication shows that she just is trying to get back at her dad for basically applying biblical standards to her life, and she's rebelling kind of like a demon would. But the main reason I'm bringing that up is not so much that issue, but the issue that through our coaching with this individual, he is actually challenging the court if they have authority to call him in to make a plea, file charges against him, arrest him, hold him in jail, require a bond, have an ankle bracelet on him, require him to reappear in any court proceedings, because there is no evidence that he did activity inland of the United States in relationship to this young girl's charge. So, and the judge is reading his briefs, and he's starting to realize, like, whoa, man, this guy's good. And so the judge is trying to get this guy to say something wrong during the motions hearings. He's trying to get him to say that he's a resident of the state. He's a resident of the county. He resides in the state. He resides in the county. If that's his zip code, if that's his address, he says, man, this judge is like, every time I'm in front of him, he's trying to trick me up and get something on the record as far as make it appear like I'm domestically in their land. I don't exactly know what the word domestically, but I think it has something to do with territorial jurisdiction, but he's trying to get that land, that aggregate nexus to the written law. All written law of the United States is somehow strongly connected to land jurisdiction, and they have to get that on there, and that's why during the court proceedings, they have like five, maybe more, ways of getting that on the record that are very stealthily done. They might have 10 of them. And we are very good at putting in the negative averments and the positive averments to make sure that that doesn't happen. So if they do try to slip something in there, we are quick to ask for findings of facts and conclusions of law on it. And who's the person that provided that information for the court? Because we want him in the witness chair, and we got some questions to ask of that individual. They don't want to do that because we can expose their land jurisdiction limitations, and that's the last thing they want. If you're in Nevada, there's a good chance that you're on government land. If you're in Connecticut, there's almost no chance that you're on government land. Now, if you're not on government land, that doesn't mean there is not a jurisdiction that applies to you. But if you're on government land, the statutory process of the U.S. court and their written laws apply to you directly. If you're not on government land, and then it defaults to the highest jurisdiction of our nation, which is American common law, which means that you get to come into a courtroom on level playing ground with the plaintiff, if you're the defendant, and duke it out in front of impartial 12 jurors. Sometimes you can knock it down to 3 jurors under certain situations. And you can even ask for a judge trial if you want, if both parties agree to it. But any questions, Michael? Sitting on the yacht here in Galveston, Texas. I got a 52-foot yacht, and mosquitoes are coming in, biting me, these rascals. At least they're not the ones that make you swell up bad. They're just barely feel them bite you. Hey, Michael, are you there? Michael.
I said, yes, I'm here. I'm glad that I was muted because I was just making fun of you.
Oh, yeah. my ears were tickling.
Okay.
I hope you feel sorry for me. I'm sitting on a yacht here and enjoying the...
No, I hope that the mosquitoes get at least a liter out of you tonight.
Yeah, probably. That might be healthier than leaving it in there.
All right.
They don't even make them mosquito tight. That's crazy. Go ahead, Michael. Okay.
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, you press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. You press star 2. So star is underneath the 7. You press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Hello, George. Get right with you in a second. For you, for those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll notice in your monitor the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty. Left-click inside of it. Type away your comment or question. On the outside of the rectangle is a place to put your name and contact information. Then you do that and hit submit. It'll refresh on my side of the screen, and I'll be able to give voice to your comment or your question. So we'll start with George. Go ahead, George.
Hi, PJ. Just a couple questions. About 20 years ago, I got involved with people who were talking about, you know, revoking, about the straw man and about being a U.S. citizen and filing UCC things and all that kind of stuff. And I basically, and then I had to go in with the IRS, and it really wasn't working. And finally, I got a judgment for like $11 million. And I thought, I can't keep playing around with this. And I just went and got a tax attorney and did, you know, tax court and all that stuff, and came away with a lot smaller bill. But anyway, so then I just sort of went, you know, back into the system, and I thought, I really don't see, you know, how this stuff can work, that the 16th Amendment was never ratified, and, you know, all of the stuff that they were talking about all sounded good, but it just seemed that any communication with the IRS just fell on deaf ears. It was basically, you know, you're being scammed, or if they answered at all, and then they just keep sending the liens. So my question is now today, I mean, I've been, you know, filing my taxes for the last 20 years and whatever, and up to date, and no problems or anything like that. If I end up going with a corp sole and doing that whole thing with Bernie and start working that, would I still, like, if I file a personal income tax return and I'm making, you know, $20,000 or $30,000 a year, and I just file a tax return just to sort of satisfy that requirement, am I basically opting into the system and agreeing to be under their jurisdiction because I'm filing a tax return, or can I be sort of out of the system, like you're saying, but yet still file a tax return?
There's only one way you can be qualified to file a 1040 tax form, and that's if you're qualified to file a 1040 tax form. You have to be you have to either have a specific status and a specific activity, and all that has to be done in a specific land. If all three of those elements come together, you have a requirement to pay a federal tax. If you do not have those three elements, then any payment of tax can at the very most, and we're actually doing that in a case right as we speak, the very most it can be elevated to is a donation. It cannot be. If it's a donation, see, we have a client that they are claiming that he shorted his income taxes $100,000 a year. And we put him in a position to prove that he had a requirement to file. and a requirement to pay a specific amount per year. And they couldn't produce that evidence. So then we come back and say that if you can't produce any evidence that he was eligible, required, liable to file and pay, then we said the most you could ever claim that that activity was is a donation. And it sounds to me like that same argument could be used in your case. Mm-hmm. So we could potentially go back and collect on all those, many of those, maybe, I don't know. They claim you can only go back 3 years, but statutorily you can only go back 3 years. Now, if it's fraud, you can go back all the way from the beginning of the fraud. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to attack it on statutory fraud. We're going to attack it on, we're going to let the jury decide. So if the jury decides that 200 years ago they cheated your grandfather, that's the way it is. So did you say something, Michael, there? I heard something in the background.
No, I'm just typing.
Okay.
I have comments when you're through.
Yeah, good. So, no, filing does give the prima facie evidence that you're have a legal duty to file and pay, but that is not factual evidence. Filing, that's just something we'd have to investigate. So if you're a person, okay, so first of all, that's a question. If you're a person, a statutory person, that's one question. And if you're making income, that's another question. And that income is domestic. That's another question. I'd have to study what the word domestic means. I think it just has something to do with location in the United States. Then you're required to file and pay. Person, income, domestic in the United States. So now it's very likely that you're not a person and you're not making an income domestically in the United States. Therefore, all that activity was simply a fraud, an activity that you did out of fear. And most juries would agree with you that you did it out of fear and that you you want your money back. They took your property under false pretense. And the jury, the common law jury, would probably look at it, the United States representatives in the trial would say, that's absolutely right. You guys can't produce any evidence that he had a requirement to file. Yet you stand here and you're trying to convince us that he did. But you can't bring any evidence in that he did or does. So they might just settle outside of court if we bring it in properly. Now, we've learned that you don't want to shout this from the rooftops because they're not going to give you an award. They're only going to give you an award if they can shut your mouth. That's kind of what we found. They'll pay you off because they'd rather give you $10 million instead of expose it and cost them $10 billion. Go ahead.
So there, if I decided that I just wanted to, you know, leave the past where it is and, you know, next year I decided I just was not going to file a tax return, would I actually send them something saying I am not required to file, therefore I'm not filing, they don't have to?
You never say you're not required to file. Okay. You never say you're not a U.S. citizen. You never say you're not a person. You never say you never made any income. You always keep the burden of proof on them on every point. The only thing you admit to is, yes, you can call me PJ, and yes, that is a mailing location you can contact me at. That's the only two things that you admit to. Otherwise, everything else, you could put the burden of proof on them. And we have those packages that we can work with you on.
Okay.
And it's something you don't want to go in without experience because
obviously.
It's a chess game. You're going to make a move. they're going to make a move. If you got to make a move back, they're going to make a move. They're going to try to – they'll even move their pawns and cheat at times. So, but we've been doing this long enough to if you walk into a U.S. court and you say, I'm not a U.S. citizen, you could very well lose your case over just that statement. Because the prosecutor will go, did you just make a statement that you're not a U.S. citizen? And you'll go, yes, I did. Did you do that under oath? Did you under oath? Under oath? Yes, I did. Your Honor, I require that the prosecutor will say, Your Honor, I require that he produce evidence to prove his statement. And you're done. You can't prove a negative. They use it as a trap. They use it as a trap. But if you if you're in a witness chair and they ask you, did you make any income? Are you a person that made income domestically in the United States? They'll never ask you that, but that's really what they're asking throughout many different ways. And you say yes or no, you'll lose your case. But if you say, I have no evidence in my possession of a person that made income domestically in the United States, then it shifts the burden of proof onto them, and they have to put somebody in the witness chair to prove that you produce evidence that you are a person that made income domestically in the United States. It's just that simple. And they're dumbfounded. When we bring that up in court, by shifting the burden to them, these attorneys, they just stand there like a deer in headlights. They go, oh, what? This has never happened to me before. Everybody always says they're a U.S. citizen and says that they don't have to pay taxes. This is bad. I don't know what to do. Go ahead.
So then if I, let's say next year, I just didn't file a return, and then do I wait for them to come back to me and say, hey, we didn't get your return?
No, you're going to – you're going to send – we have a package you send in.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You don't want to just quit paying. You need to send them a – you need to send them a request for information. They have – you're the king. You're the boss. They are the employer. The employee.
Right.
You're the employer. They have to. They have to answer your reasonable question. So they have to produce evidence. You have a requirement to file, and if you have a requirement to file, they have to do it. They have to do the filing. This self-assessment, this individual self-assessment 1040, is not a. It's not a requirement. That's an option. And they're hoping that you'll take that option. They're hoping that you think that's the only option out there. But no. Nobody has to file a 1040 tax form except a corporation. Now, if you're a person.
Wouldn't that be in violation of your Fifth Amendment?
No, you don't have the Fifth Amendment if you're required to file. Remember?
Right.
You're the one that taught me that.
Right.
But
no, I was bringing it up for everybody else.
Yeah,
somebody was
that's
thinking
right.
It.
If you have, like Michael's talking about, if you do have your right as a man, then they cannot require you to file anything because you have a right not to incriminate yourself in a criminal setting. Same way with some cop pulling you over and asking you, how fast were you driving? Give me a license, registration, insurance. And I got high level lawyers that win all their cases, and they say, sir, I'd like to take my Fifth Amendment rights here. Just give me your driver's license. Sir, I told you I'd like to take my Fifth Amendment rights here. You have to give me your driver's license. You have to ID yourself. Sir, I'd like to take my Fifth Amendment right here. I'll tell you my name. First, middle, and last name, and my birthday, and my mailing location, but that's all I'm going to tell you. But and you can do the same thing with the IRS too. And once they hear that you're starting to talk about the Fifth, they run for the hills because they don't want anybody to talk about the Fifth because the Fifth would knock out this individual self-assessment from the 1040 tax form.
You shared with me a case that you were working on with some other people in where the IRS three times moved for an extension of time. And the courts finally said no. Without naming names, would you tell us about that case? It's very important because what I want people on the call to hear is that it's about strategy. Just like they're about intimidation and threats, you're about this side of the fence is about strategy. And it's simply moving forward, sometimes slowly, but it's just moving forward one step at a time. How long has this case been going on with the IRS?
Oh,
PJ.
We've been working with them for 10 years, but it's
prosecution. How much money is it? How much money is at stake?
Prosecution-wise, it's been a year and a half, almost 2 years for the client. What was your question?
Okay. How much money is at stake?
Oh, at least 5 years in jail, I don't know how much money. Well, they're gonna if they require him to file the rest of his life, it might be in the millions.
Right.
The IRS. A lot of money.
Go ahead.
Yeah, a lot of money.
Okay. The point being is the IRS will never lose a court case ever, and they haven't lost this court case either. Because if they actually lose a court case, then you have what's called case precedence that you can apply in other court cases. And they'll never allow that. So what did they do, PJ? What did the IRS do?
They made it appear like the attorney screwed up, didn't get back on the appeals brief because they we appealed the case, and then our arguments are very simple. You know, produce the evidence that he's required to file and pay. So we put in our arguments that they have to overcome, and we try to keep these arguments so simplistic that we can get them on less than 8 pages of paper. 8 pages. I mean, when we submitted these arguments, it was 36 pages long. And we had some high-level legal people come and help us. And they said, the longer it is, the more they can catch you on it. So they shrunk that thing down to less than 8 pages, I believe it was. Real close to 8 pages. Much shorter than the 36 pages that we thought we needed to begin with. And the attorneys for the United States refused to answer, give a response in the first 30 days. So they put a motion in for a continuance, and then they got another 30 days. They put a motion in for a continuance, and they got another 30 days. So now we're on the, now they're asking for an additional extension past 90 days. And the federal judge said, nope, not going to give it to you. So it appears to us that it's going to go before the appeals board, and the United States has not refuted our arguments. And generally, if an unrefuted argument stands as persuasive, unless it's real ridiculous, so it looks to us that, not to me, but some high-level lawyers, they're telling me that the IRS, the United States did this on purpose. They intentionally did not respond. Because if they did respond, the response would fail, and they don't want anybody to know that the United States can fail at anything related to IRS taxes. So they just skip it, and they skip it, and they skip it, and then they, oh, man, we lost the case because we got busy, and we skipped it, and, well, that's the way it goes. So they our guy gets out of jail, and And they look like they just may have got too busy and forgot to take care of this brief response. So I think it was just completely planned this way. If they can't give a response, they make it look like they forgot to give a response. It's I think God hates this stuff because the Bible says make your yes be yes and your no be no. These persons, they should come. They should, if they had an honest attorney in there, he would come out and say, yes, it's true. The individual had no requirement to file and no requirement to pay this year, this year, this year, this year, and this year. And they should hand that to him, and he should be able to go out in society and show the American people and his family and his friends that he was right all the time and they were wrong. And then we can go for some substantial damages there. So does that answer your question, Michael, I think?
Well, the question was for the people on the call.
Yeah, okay.
And to understand, because I'll get the question all the time. Well, show me a case you've won. How can you when they don't lose? They never lose.
No, yeah, we've won over, 70 cases, 80 cases. And not a single one of them are going to be a precedent because the government just walks away from the case. They make it look like they just walked away for a time and they never reconvene. So it's they're just experts at covering up their fraud, their deception. It's shameful. These people are throwing people in jail and they don't have enough integrity to tell the truth. Now we've had lawyers actually come up to us. We've had court clerks come up to us. These are people employed by the federal government. And they tell us, you know, I quit my job. And why'd you quit your job? Because I realized after reading your documents that came in here that most American people don't have a legal requirement to pay. And we in the court system is hiding this from people, and I can't participate with organized crime. And we told the person, we go, man, I wish you wouldn't have quit. I wish you would have stayed in there because you could have helped us. Because, just good to have people behind, friends behind enemy lines. But anyway, that's what the court clerks would tell us. That, we quit because I can't work for organized crime. I can't stomach it. I see these good people come in and argue their cases and get mowed over by the courts. And then all of a sudden I realize that your simplistic argument that you brought in, they can't overcome it. So now most people hire an attorney and the attorney allows evidence to get on the record, false evidence to get on the record that makes it appear that you're a person has income domestically in the United States.
Let me cover that. This is very important, very important. Your attorney is an officer of the court, and they are a member of the Bar Association, be it a state bar association or federal, whatever. They're a member of the Bar Association. The third thing that they've got on their plate is their own business. They have to feed their family. They want a lifestyle that reflects their success, et cetera. So they're an officer of the court first. They're a member of the bar second. In order to feed their family well, number three, they have to take care of number two first. That's a priority to them above anything else is taking care of number one and number two as officers of the court and as members of the State Bar Association that takes care of number three. You are always number four, no matter how much money you pay them. No matter how many millions you paid them, you're over four. Remember that. The other thing that I wanted to say, what was that? Escapes me now. Oh,
I was going to say that most lawyers, let's say you get arrested for not paying taxes. They'll just gotta come in and visit you, and he says, I can represent you. The government will pay for me to represent you. I've been doing this for 30 years, and I know my stuff. And guess what? The guy's never won a case against the IRS. Never. Not one.
Then I would say to him, are you what they call a Judas goat?
Yes, it's just pathetic. But boy, they won't tell you that. But if you just keep pushing it, they'll say, I've never won a case, but I've been able to help a lot of people. You've been able to help the United States send everybody to jail. That's what he's done.
Okay.
You have a way better chance of we've won every case, but your chances are way better even if you don't use our program and dump that attorney. But I don't recommend that because that's you don't go into a high stakes with your life against a grandmaster chess player. You better bring in some other grandmasters to help you select the moves.
All right. Thank you, PJ.
Go ahead, Mike.
Our next speaker is Jennifer. But before we go there, George, do you have any other questions?
No, that's great. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Before I bring Jennifer, and she's our last caller for tonight, I want to say one other thing, too. And it's PJ that taught me this. After 25 plus years of going in a certain direction, PJ taught me something that when he said it the first time, it got me thinking about it. When he said it the second time, I was really kind of wincing my face and going, really? It's that simple? And that's this. There's a maxim of law. One who asserts a thing upon challenge must evidence their assertion, or their assertion is a nullity. Whether a policeman turns on his blue light you see in your rearview mirror, or you get indicted by a grand jury, or a cop busts you, if you would, arrests you, every one of them have made two assertions in law. They've asserted that you're on a land that they have jurisdiction on, and they're asserting that you are one of the people, or rather, more accurately, a person that they have jurisdiction over. They've made those two assertions. And the first thing that is always encouraged is that you keep your mouth shut. You assert nothing. But you simply say, PJ, what do you simply say about the evidence?
For example, you get pulled over with a car. Yeah, and they ask you, do you have a state driver's license? And then you would simply say, I have no evidence in my possession that I ever elected to get a state driver's license. Even if you have a state driver's license in your pocket, you don't qualify for that state driver's license unless you qualify for it. If you don't qualify for it, you don't have one. I don't care if it's in your pocket or not. Now, if you hand it to the officer, he's going to use it against you. But you have to qualify to be eligible. Same way with marriage license. You don't have a marriage license unless you're living on government land when you got married. This really throws a tailspin on them when we help people in marriage license issues. They don't have jurisdiction over your kids unless you're living on their land. And very few people live on their land. It's devastating to them. We get death threats about this stuff. The government doesn't want this so-called government doesn't want it exposed. They don't want family government to usurp their hopes and aspirations of state. Go ahead, Michael.
All right. So what I want you to take away from this conversation is that they've made the assertion. You challenge the assertion by demanding evidence to support their assertion, and then you keep your mouth shut. It's as simple as that. Next is Jennifer. I've unmuted you. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Hi. I guess I just think that when they say you have to sign a non-disclosure agreement or we're not going to pay you, they are forcing you, if you choose to participate in their illegal activity. And so there has to be a way to say, you owe us the money for damages, and we're not going to sign a non-disclosure because we're going to actually expose further your illegal activity or take you to court on that or something like that. You know, we've got to, there has to be a way of putting an end to their crap rather than participating in it.
Yeah, sometimes there is a principle you got to hold fast to, and it might cost you several hundred thousand dollars to hold fast to it because they'll pay less out in damages, but you've got the freedom the rest of your life to take that case and show it to the entire world. Whereas if you settled with a non-disclosure, they would pay you, and you got to keep your mouth shut the rest of your life. I'd rather actually tell the truth, almost always tell the truth instead of take those that hush money agreement. It's hard.
Can you then take them to court for trying to what do you call it when they're trying to get you to shut up about their illegal activity and they're going to pay you to do that?
You can. You can, because if you can convince the majority of 12 people sitting in a jury box in a common law court, then you got something. And you can actually, when they start showing you this, you start talking that way, they'll back off right away. But you got to remember that we do have clients that get $30-some million in judgments, and they would be lucky to get several million without agreeing to keep their mouth shut. So
I know I would rather shut them down and get nothing than participate in their.
That's right. It's because you have high standards, and those standards are perfectly good. Sometimes you can say you're going to keep your mouth shut, but your friends, they can talk all they want. So there's strategy to that.
Uh-huh. Anyway,
I've been told by a high-level lawyer that if they tell you to keep your mouth shut and they pay you a big amount and you open your mouth, your life is in danger. In some of those cases,
right.
He said, "You're alive. They will kill you."
Will they kill you if they don't give you any money and you come after them?
Well, I would assume if they kill you, you're going to open your eyes in heaven. It's not going to be that bad of a day for you. But anyway, you really got to think twice about taking that hush money.
Yeah.
Really think through it.
All right.
You got to pray. Not think through it. Pray through it.
All righty. Is there anything else, Jennifer?
That's all. Thanks.
All righty. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. It was a great call. We've had the best numbers. I'm responsible for numbers, okay? I'm the marketing guy. So we've had the best numbers tonight that we've ever had on any of PJ's calls. And I want to thank you for sharing these calls with other people, with your friends, et cetera, and continue to ask that you continue to do so. Until next week, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.